Mr. Chairman, this morning you're going to have some rookies here at the table. Next to me is Han Ha, who is sitting in. Jeff went to the graduation of his son from college last night.
Congratulations. So
that happens today. I'll pass that on to him. Han has been here this week. She's volunteered to help us out. She actually works in our budget and economic, whatever that department's called. We're happy to have her here, and she's been really enthusiastic and great, so she's going to help you out.
Thank you.
Commissioner Kajian?
Here.
Commissioner Blank? Commissioner Burke? Commissioner Clark?
Present.
Commissioner Hazel?
Here.
Commissioner Secor?
Present.
Commissioner Potter?
Here.
Commissioner Riley?
Here.
Commissioner Schallenberger?
Here.
Commissioner Wan?
Here.
Vice Chair Neely?
Here.
Chair Kruer?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Director Douglas, do you or someone from staff want to make the normal announcements on procedure?
Yes, I will. First of all, if anybody in the audience wishes to address the commission on any matter on the agenda, fill out a speaker slip. They're found on the table outside. Indicate which item you want to address and get that to the staff, and we'll get them up to the chair. Also, if you have a cell phone, please turn those off. We confiscated four of them yesterday, and that's good. We need more. So, and also, I think that's it. If you have materials to hand out, get those to the staff, too. And if you have any need for visual presentations, talk to the folks at the table over there. Mr. Chairman, let me go over the changes on the agenda.
Okay.
We're moving a number of items to consent, starting with item 12A, the Sachs matter permit. Then on page 19, or items 13A, Humboldt County Public Works, B, City of Arcata Public Works, and C, Reservation Ranch and Affiliates. Those are all moving to consent. We have a postponement of item 12D, that's the Caltrans project for Mad River Bridge. And we really worked hard to get this on the agenda today. Caltrans wanted really to move forward as quickly as possible, and we, Melanie Hale, who worked on this, worked over the weekend, worked nights to get this done, and only to find out at the last minute that there is major lead contamination at the site, and they had not addressed what they're going to do with that. Plus, they lost their agricultural land mitigation. They waited too long for a property in Arcata that was perfect for it that we had identified months and months ago. And by the time they decided that they really needed to look into it, thanks to Commissioner Neely, it was too late. They had sold the property to somebody else. So they've got to find new ag mitigation. So for those reasons, we postponed it and hope to be able to bring it back. Hopefully at the next meeting, but I can't guarantee that. So that item is postponed. With that, let me turn it over to Allison and Larry.
Good morning, Chairman Kruer and Commissioners. I just have one item to report as a part of the Energy Deputy Director report. This morning we distributed a pink sheet to you. We have one immaterial amendment. This is for a pipeline repair project that the Commission previously approved, and the amendment is to allow, if necessary, some work during the night time for up to 4 days, which means including night lighting. And we have received no objection to this immaterial amendment, and unless you have any concerns or questions, we will issue this.
Any objection to finding concurrence? Hearing none, the Commission concurs.
The other item I want to point out to you is under item 4, you received in your packet this month a SONG status report for the mitigation program. I'm personally not involved with that program, but if you have any questions about that, we can get you some answers quickly. If you don't have any questions, I'm going to turn this over to Larry Simone for the federal consistency report.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, the first item is the negative termination report, the seven negative terminations issued by the executive director this past month. If you have any questions about those, I will attempt to answer them. It's not an action item.
Is there any objection to finding concurrence with the negative determinations issued by the federal consistency staff in the staff report on these major non-energy federal consistency matters? I don't hear any objection, so we concur.
Okay, the next item is a consistency certification from the North County Transit District.
Before Larry goes to that, Commissioner Hueso asked me about the status of a matter in San Diego. This is the Manchester development project on Navy land, and apparently he recently announced that he was withdrawing his coastal permit application because the commission doesn't have jurisdiction. So Larry, why don't you give us a status report on that?
Right. Federal consistency staff spoke with our San Diego office staff a week before last about this matter. It's been our position consistently that the Navy, given the changes in the project, that the Navy needs to prepare and submit a consistency determination for the action, and that the Manchester group needs to prepare and submit a coastal development permit application to the commission for the project. The Manchester group did submit a permit application. I'm not sure exactly when. I believe it was earlier this year or late last year. That permit application has since been withdrawn. The commission staff is now in the process of preparing letters to the Manchester group and to the Navy, reiterating once again that we believe, given the changes in the project, that a coastal development permit is necessary, as is a revised consistency determination. Those letters have not been sent out yet. We're working on those letters, but it's our position that, given the changes in the project, that the commission does need to re-review the Broadway complex.
And obviously, if they don't submit the permit application and proceed, that's a violation of the Coastal Act, and we will have to take appropriate enforcement action.
And assuming they get all their local permits to build this project, they can conceivably move forward with the construction?
I don't think so.
I'm not sure what type of local permits they need, but clearly it's our position that unless they get a permit from the Coastal Commission, that any construction that would start without that permit would be in violation of the Coastal Act.
Okay, thank you.
It is on federal land, but there has been litigation, a court decision many years ago in the Granite Rock case that makes clear that even if it's on private land, they do need to get a land use development permit, and in our case, from the Coastal Commission. Whether or not that also requires a permit from the city, I don't know the answer to that. But we do know it requires a permit from us.
So that in this instance, the Navy will be notified that they're in default of a local law?
Both the Manchester group and the Navy.
The Navy does not need to get a permit from the commission. They need to prepare and get commission concurrence and a Navy consistency determination. Right. But at the same time, the Manchester group needs to obtain a coastal development permit from the commission for the project. So two actions are necessary.
I would think it would be for the applicant in this particular case, it would be foolhardy to a project of this size and magnitude involving this many dollars from institutional lenders and other people that they wouldn't go and do the whole entitlement process and look at the Coastal Commission's and the Coastal Act, because I think that they have a real problem without going through a coastal development, reaching a coastal development permit on a project of this magnitude and size and scope, even if they did have permits from the city of San Diego. So I think it would be a great big financing hurdle for anyone to overcome, but we'll wait and see. But
right, and we'll pass. I mean, the letter will be really strong, and my hope is that they're not as short-sighted as this suggests to try to circumvent the commission's jurisdiction. So with that, Larry, you can get back to your item.
For item 6A, you should have an addendum, which is an addendum to section 3D of the staff report. You should also have two letters in opposition to the project before you. And staff also received a phone call in opposing the project. The item is a consistency certification from the North County Transit District for construction of a 1.2-mile-long extension of railroad passing track and construction of a new bridge and a replacement bridge over Loma Alta Creek, and this is located at the south end of the city of Oceanside. The purpose of the project is to increase service reliability and enhance on-time performance in the Los Angeles-San Diego Rail Corridor. It does not allow for itself an increase in the number of trains using that corridor. Construction will last approximately 18 months between this summer and December of 2008. The permanent wetland loss from the concrete bridge support piers and a fill embankment slope will total 0.1 acre. Previous NCTD double track projects that included wetland fill qualified as incidental public service purposes and thus an allowable use under Section 30233 of the Coastal Act. However, in the most recent double track project reviewed by the Commission in 2005, the Commission found that the project was not an allowable use due to the likely increase in track capacity cumulatively from a series of double track projects approved by the Commission.
Obviously, somebody has their BlackBerry on. I forgot to mention that at the beginning. I'm sorry.
If a transportation project increases capacity, it is not an incidental public service and therefore is not an allowable use for wetland fill. And that project in 2005 was found to be consistent through the use of the conflict resolution provision of the Coastal Act. The proposed project, while not an allowable use, is the least environmentally damaging alternative and includes adequate mitigation for the permanent impacts to wetlands. The project also includes measures to protect water quality, provide for public access and recreation benefits by improving public transit services within the coastal zone, and would help to reduce auto miles traveled, energy consumed, and greenhouse gas emissions in this area. However, the project does create a conflict between the access, energy conservation, and air and water quality policies of the Coastal Act on the one hand, and the allowable use test of the wetland policy on the other. To resolve this Coastal Act conflict, the staff recommends that the Commission find, number one, that the impacts on coastal resources from not constructing the project would be more significant and adverse than the project's wetland habitat impacts, which will be mitigated. And number two, under Section 3007.5, concurrence with the consistency certification is consistent with the Coastal Act because it is, on balance, more protective of significant coastal resources. The staff recommends that the Commission concur with the consistency certification. The motion resolutions are found on pages 7 and 8 of the staff report. Our representatives from NCTD are present this morning and are prepared to make a presentation if you wish or can answer any questions you have about the project. This concludes the staff comments.
Thank you very much. Any ex-parties starting on my left? No ex-parties. I'll open the public hearing. John Eschenbach, are you here to answer questions, or do you like to come up and say?
I'd like to come up and
make a statement. Fine, thank you. Sir, and how much time are you requesting?
Excuse me?
How much time are you requesting?
I just need 3 minutes at this point.
Yes, sir. 3 minutes is granted.
Commissioners and staff, thank you very much for your diligent research of our permit application. I certainly do appreciate it. On behalf of California Department of Transportation, Division of Rail, our funding partner, and Amtrak, and North County Transit District Coaster folks, we agree with the staff's recommendation that a vote to concur with the permit application move forward. On a personal note, I'm a resident of the city of Oceanside, an avid beachgoer, and also a surfer. Therefore, on that personal note, I'd like to thank you for your work on the Coastal Commission. It is greatly appreciated.
Could you enter your name in the record, sir?
John P. Eschenbach, E-S-C-H-E-N-B-A-C-H.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, with that, it's the last speaker. I'll close the public hearing. Go back to staff. Anything else?
No, sir.
I'll come to the commission for the pleasure of my colleagues. A motion?
I move that the commission concur with North County Transit District's consistency certification CC00807 that the project described herein is fully consistent with the enforceable policies of the California Coastal Management Program, CCMP. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
It's been moved by Commissioner Akajian and seconded by Commissioner Secord. And the maker and the seconder are asking for a yes vote, and passage of this motion will result in an agreement with the certification and adoption of the resolutions and findings as contained in the staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion, Commissioner Akajian?
No, sir.
Commissioner Secord?
No.
Okay. Commissioner Wanick has a question.
Just a comment on the use of balancing. This is the appropriate way to use balancing. There's the Chapter 3 provisions of the Act that that are involved or that benefit if from the project. In other words, it's what the impacts are if you did not have the project balanced against the impacts of the project. That's the appropriate way to use balancing, and so I just wanted to point it out that this is a good example of the use of balancing.
Thank you, Commissioner Wan. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. The commission hereby then concurs with the consistency certification made by North County Transit District. Okay. Next item.
The next item, 8A, is a request by a fiber optic cable company to amend a cable burial survey condition of its original permit. Now, on this I can be brief, but I do need to provide a little bit of background to you on this. To date, the commission has approved 6 permits for installation and operation of offshore fiber optic cables. Each of those permits required the applicant to bury each cable if feasible, and then every 18 to 24 months thereafter to survey each of those cables to see if the buried cable remains buried. And if buried cable is exposed, then they are to rebury it. The interval of 18 to 24 months was negotiated between the companies and the affected commercial fishermen, fishermen who were concerned that unburied cable could lead to gear entanglements or loss. Both the Coastal Commission and the State Lands Commission incorporated the survey requirement as a condition of each agency's approvals. To date, each company has approved 2 rounds of these surveys, and in most, if not all cases, what we're finding is that the cables are remaining stable and buried. Back in 2005, this commission approved 1 company's request to change the survey interval from every 18 to 24 months to every 5 years. Commercial fishermen support this change.
Phantom of Santa Rosa.
The fishermen are supporting this change. One of the reasons is because actually doing the surveys themselves actually leads to interference with commercial fishing. And these surveys also do have significant air emissions associated with them. So we are recommending today that you do approve a change in the survey interval to every 5 years. That is the case. We're going to be recommending approval to you for a number of these projects as long as we have evidence that the cable is remaining stable and buried, and that is the case for this particular cable system. Now, in addition to the proposed change in the permit condition, the applicant also proposes to modify its consistency certification. So on page 3 of your staff report, there are actually 2 motions for this item, and that concludes my staff presentation.
Thank you very much. We have any ex parties on this, starting my left? No ex parties. We have no speaker slips. Commissioner Akajian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are 2 motions to be made. The first motion is I move that the commission approve the proposed amendment to Coastal Development Permit E98027. Recommend a yes vote.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. Did you, am I looking at the right motion? I just want to make sure we did this correctly here. Sorry. I'm not sure. You're okay. Yes. Is there any, would you like to speak to your motion?
No, sir.
Would you like to say anything? Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this? Hearing none, The commission unanimously approves this item.
Second motion, Mr. Chair. I move that the commission concur with PAC Landing Corporation modification to consistency certification CC04100 for the proposed change in survey intervals, finding that the coastal zone effects are not substantially different than originally described, and the project, as modified, continues to be consistent with the enforceable policies of the California Coastal Management Program. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded, and the maker and the second of the motion are asking for a yes vote. Would you like to speak to your motion?
No, sir.
Would you like a second? Is there any objection to unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission hereby concurs with the modified consistency certification made by PAC Landing Corporation, finding the project as modified does not have coastal zone effects that are substantially different from the project as originally reviewed, and that the project continues to be consistent with the California Coastal Management Program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That brings us to the findings, 9A and B. Tom Lester will make these presentations.
Would you speak?
Can you hear me? There we are. Good morning, Chair Kruger and Commissioners. Item 9A and B are recommended revised findings for a pilot desalination facility to be built and operated by the California American Water Company at the Moss Landing Power Plant in Monterey County. The Commission approved the coastal development permit for this facility in December 2006. In addition to the recommended findings you received in your packet, staff provided you this morning with an addendum that includes several recommended modifications, correspondence from CalAM, and two ex parte forms. As you know, the purpose of a hearing on proposed revised findings is not to revisit the merits of the proposed project, but is to address whether the proposed findings accurately reflect the Commission's decision when it approved the coastal development permit. Additionally, in a revised findings hearing, those commissioners eligible to vote are those that were on the prevailing side of the vote at the initial hearing. Those commissioners are listed on the front page of the staff report. You may recall that staff previously presented you with proposed findings for this project in February and May of this year. At those hearings, CalAM objected to the characterization in those findings that the desalination facility represented an intensification of water use. Staff believes that this current version of the proposed findings addresses CalAM's concerns on this issue. However, CalAM has raised some new concerns in a letter staff received earlier this week, and which is included in the addendum you received this morning. Staff reviewed the letter and recommends that you adopt 5 of CalAM's 7 requested modifications. The other 2 requested changes are brand new issues that are not supported by the record, and staff believes they do not reflect the Commission's decision. First, CalAM's letter requests that the revised findings delete a reference to Elkhorn Slough as being the source water body for the proposed project. That is found near the top of page 8 on the findings. Since receiving the letter, staff now understands that CalAM is fine with the reference as written. And so they're essentially withdrawing that request. Second, CalAM's letter requests that a statement be added to the revised findings stating that CalAM does not agree that County Ordinance Section 1072 is a part of the LCP. That ordinance requires all desalination facilities in the county be publicly owned and operated. They have also requested 2 deletions that refer to this ordinance on page 13, the last sentence of paragraph 2, and footnote 6, also on page 13. This request, too, is a brand new issue that was not a part of the Commission's deliberations. The December staff report established that the ordinance was incorporated by reference into the LCP. During the December hearing and in correspondence received before the hearing, both CalAM and the county argued that the pilot project did not have to be publicly owned because it was a test facility only and because it would not provide drinking water. They did not argue that the ordinance was not a part of the LCP. This contention was neither presented nor discussed during the Commission's deliberations in December and was not a part of the previous correspondence from CalAM or the county. In closing, staff is recommending the Commission approve the revised findings as amended in the addendum. And with that, I'll close.
Thank you very much. With that, ex parties, starting on my left. Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a brief discussion with Susan McCabe day before last on this topic, wherein she advised to me that the staff recommendation of inclusion of the statement and condition of it being publicly owned and operated was factually incorrect. She also provided me a copy of the letter provided to staff from Cal Water. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. Any other ones on my left?
Mr. Chair, I had a conversation last week with Ken Turner of Cal-Am expressing his concerns regarding the findings similar to those mentioned by staff. I had a voicemail message from Mr. Turner Tuesday explaining his inability to be at this meeting because of a conflict with a PUC meeting. And I also had a brief conversation with Susan McCabe yesterday regarding the suggested modifications to be made to the findings.
Thank you. I had an ex-party phone call on June 8th from Susan McCabe, and Ms. McCabe discussed the latest version of the revised findings for the approval of Cal-Am Water Pilot's desal facility and the results of which will be used to design a permanent desal plant as a yet-to-be-determined location will be complying with State Water Resources Control Board order to restore the overdraft water to Carmel River. She also said that Cal-Am is working with the Coastal staff to ensure that the findings are legally adequate to defend the Commission's decision. She said that they were preparing a letter outlining those issues and hope to resolve them by the Commission hearing on Friday, today. Any other? Mr. Secord.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had substantially the same conversation with Susan McCabe on Saturday, June the 9th. The other issue brought up had to do with the notion of the publicly owned water facilities issue.
Commissioner Akaja.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is on file.
Thank you very much. And with that, we'll open the public hearing. Tim Miller.
Good morning.
Mr. Miller, how much time are you requesting?
3 minutes should be adequate.
Granted, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Tim Miller. I'm corporate counsel for California American Water. I'm presenting California American Water's comments today on behalf of company president Kent Turner, who has a conflicting meeting with a member of the PUC and regretfully cannot attend this proceeding. We are here for the third time to address findings prepared by staff memorializing this commission's decision made 6 months ago. When this matter was before you last month, the primary issue that required resolution was whether the operation of the pilot plant constituted an intensification of water use. The findings before you today properly address that issue. But there are other incorrect statements in the findings that require attention, some merely typographical, some are substantive. You have been or are being provided with a copy of our June 11th letter sent to staff raising 7 concerns. As staff noted, 5 of those concerns have been addressed by the issuance of the addendum. As to the 2 remaining concerns, as Mr. Luster stated, we are not going to continue to press our concerns over the reference to Elkhorn Slough. The most significant issue, however, is whether Monterey County Ordinance 1072 is part of the local coastal program. This is discussed on page 13 of the May 25th staff report and findings. It's very important that you focus on that sentence. The staff report states that this commission found at the substantial issue hearing that Monterey County Ordinance 1072 is part of the local coastal program. This inaccurately characterizes the commission's action on October 12, 2006. The findings and declarations in support of the substantial issue motion present the appellant's contentions and the commission's concurrence that those contentions raise substantial issues. This resolution does not declare the scope of the local coastal program. Reading the findings and declarations in that manner is consistent, first and foremost, with Section 13115 of the Commission's regulations, and secondly, with the Commission's historical practice that the only finding the Commission makes on a substantial issue appeal is that there is a substantial issue. Just as compelling, Commission staff has previously gone on record that Monterey County Ordinance 1072 is not part of the LCP. They made that statement in a February 26, 2004 staff report on the periodic review of Monterey County's local coastal program and suggested a modification to the LCP to include that. While we had initially requested that a statement just be made that we disagree with that, we are, on further reflection, believe that to properly and accurately characterize what staff, what the Commission had decided, the references to in footnote 6 and the last sentence of the second paragraph should merely be stricken. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. No other speakers. We'll close the public hearing. Return to staff.
I guess just one comment at this point. The basic question before the Commission is, did the Commission adopt findings in December based on the county's ordinance being part of the LCP? And based on the record, staff would say that the answer is yes to that.
Thank you, sir. That I'll return.
I'm sorry. Through the chair, I'd like to follow up on that. It's important to keep in mind that the purpose of revised findings is to accurately reflect the Commission's action that occurred at the December meeting. As Mr. Luster explained earlier in his presentation, neither CalAM nor the county during the proceedings up through the December hearing argued that this provision was not part of the LCP. So the arguments that they're presenting now after the December hearing regarding Section 10.72 not being in the LCP is not an appropriate kind of change to take after the Commission action on the permit.
Okay. Thank you, sir. And with that, I'll return to the Commission for deliberation. Commissioner Potter.
Mr. Chair, I'm prepared to make a motion, an amending motion. If I get a second, I'll speak to it. I move that the Commission adopt the conditions and revised findings in support of the Commission's action of December 14th, 2006, concerning approval of Coastal Development Permit Number A-3-MCO-06-384. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
Okay, I'd offer an
amendment. Commissioner Potter has made the motion, and Vice Chair Neely has seconded that motion. And passage of this motion will result in the adoption of the conditions and revised findings as set forth in the staff report. And the commissioners that are eligible to vote on this are Commissioner Akajian, Commissioner Clark, Commissioner Secord, Commissioner Kruer, Commissioner Neely, Commissioner Potter, Commissioner Schallenberger.
Mr. Chair, I'd offer an amending motion. That motion would be to, on page 13, to delete the last sentence of paragraph 2, which reads, as determined by the Commission at its October 12th, 06 substantial issue hearing for this proposed project, this ordinance is within the county's LCP jurisdiction. And then I would move to delete in its entirety subparagraph 6 on the same page, which begins with, briefly, the Commission found, and ends with, and as a specific provision of the land use plan. That would be my amending motion.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Potter, seconded by Vice Chair Neely. And they're asking to make the modifications as just stated by Commissioner Potter on page 13 of the staff report.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Before you go into this, can I ask counsel whether we need to go into closed session? This matter is in litigation.
Well, then why are we having the findings before us? I'm simply amending the findings to accurately reflect, as counsel guided me, to go ahead and accurately reflect what the Commission did at that hearing date. It's my belief that my amending motion does reflect what we did. I don't see any need to go into closed session if we're going to adopt the findings. Just because you don't like what I'm doing doesn't mean we have to go to closed session.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Clark.
I'm a little lost on the nuance on this. Can we go back over
this matter and to help me understand the amending motion. Before I take a position on it, I'd like to understand the nuance that staff sees in the issue vis-a-vis what my colleague has proposed. So can you go back through this? What is the issue again?
The main issue is that during the commission's deliberations and in the correspondence we received prior to the deliberations in December and CalAM's presentation at the time in December, the arguments made were not about whether the county's ordinance requiring public ownership of desal facilities was part of the LCP. They are about why the pilot project being proposed was not subject to that ordinance. The various letters that we received over about a two-year period prior to that hearing never raised that as an issue. And so the commission was operating with the understanding that the ordinance applied to the, or the ordinance was part of the LCP, but the pilot project was not subject to that ordinance because, as the county argued and CalAM argued, it was not providing potable water for drinking. It was a test facility only.
Okay, to follow up on that, was it expressed in the hearing on this matter that we discussed and made aware of that it was part of the LCP, this ordinance?
Yes, in both the substantial issue hearing and in the staff report for the December hearing. Ordinance 1072 was part of the staff report. The discussion about it was why the pilot project wasn't subject to its requirements. There was no discussion that ordinance should not be included in the LCP.
Staff counsel.
Yes, just to follow up on that, the proposed revised findings show in strikeout and underline the changes to the December staff report. So if you look at page 13, the portions that are proposed to be deleted are statements that were in the December 2006 staff report. And at the December hearing, there was not discussion about that text. The applicant, the county, did not raise this issue at that time. So it would not be appropriate to make a change to those findings at this point.
In fact, staff is now concurring with the county and CalAM's position that because the pilot project doesn't provide drinking water, it doesn't need to get the permits that would be required under the county ordinance.
Ms. Patterson, do you have something to add to this?
I agree with what staff counsel has said. If you have findings before you in December and you do not discuss and you do not make any affirmative changes to portions of those findings, it's inappropriate to make a change subsequently. Those findings need to reflect what you actually did in December. And I would suggest that if you want to discuss this further, we probably should go into closed session.
I think at this point we should go into closed session.
I agree.
Okay. Ask the public to. Okay, would you counsel? I go to council to report on the. Oh, I'm still technical difficulties. Are we ready? Okay, thank you very much. With that, I'll go to staff counsel to report on the closed session.
Yes, through the chair, the commission met in closed session to receive advice from counsel regarding pending litigation that's related to this matter and took no action. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Presently, we have a main motion, and we have an amending motion. Would anyone else like to? Commissioner Potter, I'll go back to you.
I'm going to just call the question and simply state that in 1072 is not included in the LCP. It's inaccurate that it states that it is, and that reference should be removed. And that's all I'm trying to do is keep this consistent with accurate findings for the meeting that occurred. So I'm the motion stands.
Commissioner Wan.
Just a quick statement. I can't vote on the motion, but I was a part of the process. So I will say that for it to be a change to the findings, and that statement has to have been made and agreed to at the time of the hearing.
Commissioner Secoy.
Just a minor question. Would the findings be more accurate after this, if this motion succeeds? Or does it not matter?
Is that to the council or? Yeah.
It's a question for the commission in terms of determining the accuracy of the findings.
Okay. Okay. Other commissioners? Do you have anything to say? Okay. Okay. Would you call those? He's asking for a yes vote, and
Should we take a roll call vote
on
this?
Yeah, we're going to have to take a roll call
okay,
vote.
Okay, so I'll read the names of the eligible commissioners, and this is to vote on the motion, the amending motion. Commissioner Ashajian?
Aye.
Commissioner Clark?
No.
Commissioner Secord?
Aye.
Commissioner Kruer?
No.
Commissioner Neely?
Aye.
Commissioner Potter? Commissioner Schallenberger?
No.
4-3. What?
No.
Is that right? I wasn't keeping score. 4-3, the motion passes.
Motion passes. Okay. Main motion. There's been a motion made by the maker and seconder are asking for a yes vote, and passage of this motion will result in the adoption of the conditions and revised findings as set forth in the staff report. And let's call the roll on this. Again, they're asking for a yes vote.
This would be the same group of commissioners. Commissioner Ashajian?
Aye.
Commissioner Clark?
No.
Commissioner Secord?
Aye.
Commissioner Kruer?
Yes.
Commissioner Neely?
Yes.
Commissioner Potter?
Aye.
Commissioner Schallenberger?
No.
Okay, that passes.
And yeah, then that passes, and then I believe
there's
a second
another motion.
Right.
And you need a second motion on the bottom of page 3. Bottom of page 3 and 4. Motions on page 4.
I move the commission adopt the conditions and revised findings in support of the commission's actions of December 14th, 2006 concerning approval of coastal development permit number E-05-005. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Potter, seconded by Vice Chair Neely. Passage of this motion will result in the adoption of the conditions and revised findings as set forth in this staff report.
Are you going to make an amending motion to?
You're going to make an amending motion, Commissioner Potter?
Consistent with the previous amending motion?
It would be the same thing.
Which was to on page 13 to delete the sentence, as determined by the commission at its October 12, 2006 substantial issue hearing for this proposed project. This ordinance is within the county's LCP jurisdiction and applies to this project, proposed project, and then subparagraph 6 in its entirety.
Moved by Commissioner Potter, seconded by Vice Chair Neely. Is there any reason that we can't use the previous vote on this, or do you want to call the roll?
I don't think you can use the previous vote.
Not the previous. I mean, the one on the first amendment motion.
I think we ought to call
motion.
The roll.
We'll call the roll then.
Okay. Commissioner Shajian?
Aye.
Commissioner Clark?
No.
Commissioner Secord?
Aye.
Commissioner Kruer?
No.
Commissioner Neely?
Aye.
Commissioner Potter?
Aye.
Commissioner Schallenberger? No. Now you're on the main motion.
Yeah.
That motion passes.
The commission hereby adopts the conditions as findings, et cetera, as stated.
The main motion, as amended.
As amended.
Right. So I'm going to call the roll on this one. Commissioner Ashajian?
Aye.
Commissioner Clark?
No.
Commissioner Secord?
Aye.
Commissioner Kruer?
Yes.
Commissioner Neely?
Yes.
Commissioner Potter?
Aye.
Commissioner Schallenberger?
No.
That motion passes. The findings as amended have been adopted. Finally. So that brings us to the North Coast. And the first item on the North Coast is the consent calendar. And if Jim and Melissa can join me up here. Joining me at the table are two of your North Coast staff members, Jim Baskin and Melissa Kramer, who I'm delighted to say is now working for the Coastal Commission. We're really fortunate to have Melissa's talent and expertise in plants and her knowledge of the North Coast working for the Coastal Commission. The first item that we have is the consent calendar, and as I indicated, we moved a number of items to the consent calendar, 12A, 13A, B, and C. And if there's anybody in the audience that wishes to address any of those items, this would be the time. So the consent calendar as provided to you for today is before you. Item number
one. Any motion?
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Secord and seconded by Vice Chair Neely. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved.
That brings us to item 12B, City of Arcata Restoration Project, and I'll turn the mic over to Jim Baskin.
Chairman Kruer and Commission members, good morning. Item 12B is a permit application by the City of Arcata for a rather significant restoration project on the north end of Humboldt Bay. What is proposed is to take roughly one-third of the roughly 600-acre area that has been reclaimed along northern Humboldt Bay and restore it to a combination of intertidal salt marsh and brackish water habitat, a 205-acre component of that. And then the remaining 35-acre area would be a combination of impounded freshwater and freshwater ponds and riparian areas that would be located between the restoration site, the saltwater restoration site, and the adjacent Arcata Marsh and Wildlife Sanctuary areas. To do this, the reclamation levees that are located along Humboldt Bay would be parted in two places and allow for intertidal flows into the 205-acre area. To keep the flows from just flowing willy-nilly onto the adjacent farmlands, a new dike field would be constructed on the order of 21,000 lineal feet in an inland location on the perimeter of the restoration site. In addition, there would be a number of other improvements made in terms of deepening some of the tidal channels, the remnant tidal channels in the area, doing restoration plantings by native species appropriate for a marsh plain elevation that would support pickleweed marsh plants, and also the incorporation of public access facilities on the dike levee tops.
I have a couple of visuals that may help with this. If the staff might be able to bring up slide number 4, that might be helpful. Number 4, please. McDaniel Slough. And slide number 4, please. There you go. One back. This is a site map for the project, which shows an overview of the various improvements that would be made. Again, in particular, the reclamation dike along Northern Humboldt Bay would be parted in two places at the mouth of McDaniel Slough, and a new dike field created along the periphery of the property around the 205-acre salt marsh area. In addition, the area up in the northeastern portion of the property would be excavated out to form two freshwater ponds, as would an area of roughly 18 acres in size for brackish marsh that would interconnect with the upper flows from the salt marsh coming into the site. Okay, thank you. If I can quickly go through some of the project objectives, again, it's to restore 205 acres of reclaimed degraded grazing land to intertidal salt marsh. The area has been reclaimed for roughly 130 years, and even though it has some agricultural use, it's rather marginal in its character, is subject to saltwater intrusion past the tide gates that have been established in the levee field, and is also just undergoing regional subsidence. It's also to expand the adjacent wildlife refuge, tertiary water treatment, and coastal access and recreational facilities located both to the east and west of the site. To the west is the Department of Fish and Game's Mad River Slough Wildlife Area that spans well over toward the Mad River Slough toward the Pacific Ocean. And to the east is, again, the Arcata Marsh and Wildlife Sanctuary on either side of the McDaniel Slough waterway. The project would also intend to provide biological filtration treatment of stormwater runoff from the adjacent industrial urban areas on the periphery of the site, which include a variety of light manufacturing and timber processing, electronic control concerns. And also facilitate reuse of treated wastewater from the adjacent municipal wastewater treatment plant, the Arcata Marsh system again. In this particular case, the new project would be off to the northwest of the existing Arcata complex. Among some of the project issues before us, before the commission, is the conversion of agricultural lands. The site does have grazing. At one point, it was entirely grazed. Currently, only 45 acres, the easternmost portion, is grazing. But again, because of the saltwater intrusion problems and subsidence of the area, that grazing is rather marginal. Section 30241 of the Coastal Act directs that conversions of agricultural lands are to be limited to areas which do not ideally involve prime agricultural lands and are marginal in character, and ideally are those located on the urban fringes where there may be conflicts in between those urban and adjacent rural uses where such a conversion would actually serve to provide a buffer. If you look to the west of the site, this is more the character that is going off the site to the west in terms of its agricultural nature, much more so than the urbanized areas to the east within Arcata proper. The other issue that comes up with this project is whether or not a complete restoration of the full 240 acres is appropriate. Section 30240 of the Coastal Act directs that, 30 of the Coastal Act directs that whenever feasible, marine resources are to be restored. And indeed, it is technologically feasible to restore the entire project site to marine resources by building the new dike field around the entire perimeter of it. However, as I mentioned, the project is being undertaken for a variety of reasons, and that includes such things as tying into the adjacent Arcata Marsh and Wildlife Sanctuary, the public trail system that exists there, the wastewater facilities there, and also to provide for more controlled biofiltration treatment of the runoff that's coming from the adjacent urbanized areas on the northeastern fringe of the site. Given that, staff believes that this project is consistent with the conversion policies and supported accordingly. Here's another oversight map, again showing the relative location of those non-marine restored areas in the northeastern portion of the site relative to the industrial sites. The final issue before us relative to the approval of the project is the appropriate level of public access that should be incorporated within the project. Currently, the western two-thirds of the site under the Department of Fish and Game ownership is closed generally to public access through the majority of the refuge. There are limited access points and trail systems more to the west, but for the most part, the area is managed as a wildlife refuge with no provision for public access. The site map, again, shows how the applicants would integrate, primarily again on the east side, through the new dikes that would be constructed, a trail system. This would go back out along the reclamation levee to the breach site, as well as going along the perimeter of the brackish and freshwater ponds. In the initial project description that was provided, a linkage was provided out, was also included out to Samoa Boulevard, Highway 255. However, that was subsequently dropped in the final EIR. Staff approached the applicants to try to include that again in some form within the project before the commission. And indeed, an amendment to the application was made to include a 800-foot lineal connection along the northeastern side of the project out to Samoa Boulevard, and the city was agreeable to that. However, in subsequent discussions with their partners, the Department of Fish and Game, there is some question as to whether or not that offer may have been premature. There's a number of issues that the applicants will be discussing in their presentation with regard to the problematic nature of that connection. However, staff do believe that the through circulation for public access for this project is important and accordingly should be included and required as is set forth in condition number 13 of the
we
permit.
We just have one speaker slip on this.
Right. Let me elaborate on that last point Jim made. In discussions with the applicant, the city, we're aware that the Department of Fish and Game is opposed to the access. The representative couldn't be here today, but we're conveying her concerns to you. I would suggest that we amend our condition to maintain the public access as the staff is recommending, but through adaptive management, allow them to close to public access during periods of bird presence that could be disturbed by the public use, so that they could, during the time of the Aleutian geese being there, close it off. But we think that the access should not be eliminated entirely. So that's a modification we're making in our recommendation. And I've talked to the applicant about it, and they're accepting of that change.
Okay.
I don't think that changes the Department of Fish and Game's concern, but at least it's an attempt to try to compromise with them.
between the two policy conflicts. That completes the staff recommendation.
Thank you, Director Douglas. That are ex parte, so starting on my left. Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a brief conversation with Mark Andre and Julie Nander from the City of Arcata this morning. They indicated they are in agreement with the special conditions in the staff report.
Thank you, Vice Chair Neely. Any other ex parties? If not, we'll open up the public hearing. Mark Andre? Are you here to answer questions, or you would like to talk?
Brief overview, and then...
Okay. How much time, sir?
We'll ask for 15 minutes, but I don't think it'll take that long.
Okay.
And there is a... I think it's MC Coastal file.
Between you and Ms. Neander?
Julie Neander, yes.
Okay, you're going to be splitting up to 15
we'll
minutes.
We'll split to 15.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair and members of the Commission. I'm Mark Andre, the Director of Environmental Services with the City of Arcata, and Julie Neander will follow up my brief presentation overview with more of the detail on the permit application we have before you. And I have a few slides here. I'll go very quickly here since staff, Jim Baskin, did an excellent job with his staff report. I do want to commend the Eureka staff for their assistance on this project. Just to summarize, the project goal is to create a self-sustaining tidal marsh through the restoration of natural, geomorphic, and biological processes. We are in partnership with the Department of Fish and Game on this project. There is a flood control aspect as well, and a fish passage aspect. This slide illustrates the location of the project in the lower right-hand corner, and it is totally within former diked tidelands. Or actually, it's diked tidelands now, but it's former wetlands and salt marsh, as you can see from this 1870 photo here. So there is a public trust connection, as well as a true restorative aspect to this project, restoring the conditions that were present 100-plus years ago. This, on the left, I don't have a pointer with me, but the area to the upper left shows the project area in relationship to other coastal public lands. All the areas shaded are either owned by Department of Fish and Game, City of Arcata, or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Humboldt Bay Wildlife Area. Another map showing the 1870 vegetation conditions with the project area within former salt marsh habitat. I'm going to skip over this. Jim Baskin, staff, discussed the project itself. I do want to acknowledge that the firm Philip Williams and Associates helped the city initially with a grant from the Coastal Conservancy to develop the project design. We've modified that a bit based on public scoping, and we came up with the preferred alternative during that process. We've taken about 5 years going slow with this project. I don't have a pointer, but this slide illustrates the current condition in the channel of McDaniel Slough is that of a choked, silted-in situation. And we are restoring anadromy, coho salmon, steelhead, and Chinook salmon should be able to occupy the watershed once we're completed. It's a huge flood control benefit for the City of Arcata as well. Oh, thank you. This shows the current base of the stream channel bottom, and this shows post-restoration after about 10 years of down-cutting. This area here is approximately 40,000 cubic yards of accumulated silt that will be taken out of the project area, increasing channel capacity. This slide is just to simply illustrate the number of alternatives that we tested and the analysis that we did during the past 5 years to come up with the best, we think, alternative that achieves the goals of the project. The partners to date are Fish and Wildlife Service, Department of Fish and Game, State Coastal Conservancy, Natural Resources Conservation Service, recently awarded $500,000 towards this project under the Wetland Reserve Program. The NOAA Restoration Program, Wildlife Conservation Board, Janes Creek Flood District, Redwood Community Action Agency, State Transportation Commission, and Fish and Game Oil Spill Remediation and Response Program, as well as the City of Arcata. The Fish and Wildlife Grants are the Coastal Wetland Grant and the NACA Division of Bird Habitat funding. We think this project is consistent with quite a few of our own policies, as well as the Coastal Act, including our own general plan, Stormwater Master Plan, and our Creeks Management Plan, and the Humboldt Bay Watershed Salmonid Plan. And side benefit also, it's consistent with our Greenhouse Gas Action Plan. The salt marsh will sequester a significant amount of carbon, and we are going to measure that along with our community forest carbon sequestration as part of our tracking of our emissions and storage of CO2. So that briefly outlines the highlights of the overview. I think I'll turn it over to Ms. Neander now to speak more to the details of the permit, and I'm available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and Commission members. And I'd also like to let you know that it really is a great privilege to be able to work with your North Coast staff. They're very helpful. I wanted to just briefly go through the special conditions. One, to assure you that...
Could you state your name for the record, please?
Sorry. My name is Julie Neander. I work for the City of Arcata as a resource specialist.
Thank you.
Special condition number one, which is a requirement for a restoration monitoring program. The city's been working closely with both Department of Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service, and NOAA Fisheries to really make sure that we have a good program in place. All of those agencies, as well as the city, are very committed to looking at this project and understanding it well so that it can be a good basis for future restoration enhancement projects in Humboldt Bay. Special condition number two, which has to do with construction materials, waste being removed from the site, that's all fine. I wanted to really emphasize that our project will be one where we'll be doing excavation of those freshwater ponds and at the same time concurrently building the levees or building up the marsh plain. There will be no stockpiling of additional material anywhere to, you know, potentially cause problems with erosion and sediment. And to that effect, I was hoping to ask if we could extend that work window. Currently, right now, I think it's June through October 1st, and we were looking at requesting whether or not we could go from May 15th to November 15th if no significant rainfall events occur or are forecast during that work period. The city will be monitoring the weather forecast, and we will also be implementing all our sediment and erosion control as we go along with the process so that the project would be ready and be button-downable basically with any, you know, short-term forecast saying there's going to be rain. We'd have our erosion and sediment control in place. So that was one request to make. And then we will be doing, we're fine with three. Number four, all our seed collection and cuttings will be local vegetative stock. All of the other permitting and regulatory agencies have been contacted. We've been working closely with them to make sure we're in compliance with that. That's pretty much, and City and Fish and Game are certainly willing to assume the risks associated with the project. And then the final one is the trail linkage, which was mentioned already by Peter Douglas. Fish and Game really does have concerns about wildlife impacts. If there's currently a Aleutian goose use of that property, we also don't know what the potential future use of other species will be once the bay is opened up and we have more tidal influence in that area, adjacent to that area. We have not been able to work with Caltrans on whether or not that will cause problems for them in terms of encroachment and access to and from 255. And just to reiterate that the city is working on another public access just a little bit east of the area that would provide pedestrian, bicycle, and also automobile access off of K Street right across 255 to that area to connect with all those trails. And we're conditioning that for a development proposal in the city so that we're also very committed to providing public access to this area. And you'll see that even though Fish and Game really has not wanted to see public access, the city area does have a number of trails atop the levees. So I think that's it for me. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll go back to staff.
Mr. Chairman, we have no additional comments, so we suggest that you adopt the staff recommendations at, with the conditions as modified.
Thank you. Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have I'm going to put a motion on the floor first. I move that the Commission approve Coastal Development Permit Number 1-06-036 pursuant to the staff recommendation and recommend a yes vote.
Second.
And I had a question for staff on condition, special condition two. They requested that the season be expanded, or that, you know, that the season be expanded.
We already have the authority to do that.
All
if
right.
We find that there's a problem and justification for it. We can do that administratively.
All right. Thank you very much.
There's a motion by Vice Chair Neely and a second by Commissioner Potter. The maker and seconder are asking for a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the approval of the permit as conditioned and the adoption of the following resolutions and findings as contained in the staff report and as modified today. Would you like to speak to your motion?
Vice Chair Neely? I think it's the staff did a great job. Thank you very much, and thanks to the City of Arcata as well.
Okay. Question before we call them.
I have a question, and I don't know if staff can answer it or the city can answer it, because this is fish and game. Is there going to be hunting allowed in this area? And the reason I ask that has to do with the public access, because I can't tell you how many times I go to refuges run by Department of Fish and Game where hunters are allowed in, but the public who wants to go birdwatch is not allowed in. And it seems to be okay with them for the hunters to be there, but the public, quote, is a danger to the species. So can you tell me where the hunting's going to be allowed?
Through the chair, I'm not intimately familiar with the management of hunting on the wildlife refuge to the west. My understanding is duck hunting, other birds are allowed on the open waters of Humboldt Bay. As far as the city's portion where there would be the public access trails, I do not believe, and perhaps
maybe,
Mr. Andre can
Yeah, I'd like
that,
to hear from the city.
Yes, is, that there would not be any hunting.
Is there going to be hunting allowed on this restoration area?
Not within the City of Arcata's portion, which is the...
Would you give us your name, please?
Mark Andre, City of Arcata. There's no hunting allowed in the city's marsh and wildlife area, which includes the area to the east of McDaniel Slough. The area to the west is owned by the Department of Fish and Game, and hunting is allowed on that portion. All of the public access elements of the project before you are on the City of Arcata side.
Okay, so all of this project is on the City of... Okay, this.
Well, just the trail system. The restoration includes both City of Arcata and
here's my concern. You're saying that the Department of Fish and Concern has concerns about public access and their impact on public on the species, and that's inconsistent from my perspective of a department that takes the position that they're going to allow hunting there. What could have a greater effect on the species than to kill them?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's a question for the city, because that's not their policy.
No.
I understand, and that's exactly one of the concerns that we've had with the Department of Fish and Game in a number of areas, and that's why we're not changing our recommendation as to public access.
Ah, but you have changed it. You've said that you're going to allow them to, quote, do adaptive management and possibly not have public access, and that's why I was explaining my experiences with the Department of Fish and Game. That frequently means that the public who's there to simply watch and look at the species is not allowed, but the public that wants to kill them is.
Well, let me modify the condition then to say adaptive management that would permit closure to protect wildlife with the concurrence of the executive director.
That would be fine.
Then we can look at that issue as they come forward. Okay?
Is that okay with the maker and the seconder of the motion? Okay.
Thank you.
With that, is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. The commission hereby approves the coastal development permit for the proposed development and adopts the findings as set forth in the staff report.
Yes, and I want to thank the representatives of the city for working with us on this so closely. This was a pleasant experience.
With that, let's go to the next item. Melissa Kramer is going to make the presentation on this item.
Good morning. This project is an appeal by the Friends of Schooner Gulch and Commissioners Kruer and Riley from the decision of the County of Mendocino granting a modification to a coastal development permit with conditions to Robert and Pamela Nelson to construct a 480-square-foot garage attached to a 1,728-square-foot single-family home to legalize the placement of a retaining wall used in conjunction with the planting bed for screening vegetation on the eastern side of the home and to place a 44-square-foot storage shed on an existing deck at 30150 South Highway 1, approximately 5 miles south of Point Arena in Mendocino County. There's a green addendum for this project, which you should all have copies of. It contains 10 letters. One letter is from the applicants responding to issues raised in the staff report. Another letter is also from the applicants and includes several additional letters in support of the garage from various neighbors and community members. The applicant's letter also enclosed a copy of a geology report from 1980 attesting to the general stability of the parcel. And the remaining 8 letters are all in support of the proposed garage from various neighbors and community members. And there was one additional support letter in support of the garage that was distributed to you this morning. On February 16, 2007, the Coastal Commission found that the appeal of the County of Mendocino's conditional approval of coastal development permit modification for the subject development raised a substantial issue with respect to the grounds on which the appeal had been filed. Staff recommends that the Commission approve with conditions the coastal development permit for the proposed project in a manner that would not authorize the proposed garage, but would conditionally approve the proposed storage shed and landscape berm with its associated retaining wall. Staff believes that, as conditioned, the project is consistent with the Mendocino County LCP. The primary issue raised by the project is its consistency with the visual resource protection policies of the LCP. The subject property is located approximately 5 miles south of Point Arena on the west side of State Highway 1 within an area designated as highly scenic in the LCP. The 1.5-acre parcel sits atop a steep, approximately 90-foot-high bluff that overlooks Iverson Landing, which is also known as Island Cove, and Island Beach, an approximately 700-foot-long private beach that is one of the few sand beaches of its kind along the southern Mendocino coastline. The primary component of the project is construction of the 480-square-foot, 16-foot-high garage attached to the existing residence on the north side within the public view corridor available to travelers along State Highway 1. The other project components, legalization of the landscape berm and associated retaining wall and placement of the storage shed on the existing deck, are relatively minor and are recommended for approval with conditions in the staff report. The LCP policies and standards governing the protection of visual resources at the site require that permitted development be sited and designed to protect views to and along the ocean and scenic coastal areas, and that new development permitted in designated highly scenic areas provide for the protection of oceans and coastal views from public areas, including highways and roads. Staff recommends that the Commission find that the proposed garage cannot be found consistent with the visual resource protection policies of the LCP. The coastline in this particular area is designated in the land use plan as highly scenic. The views that are afforded through the view corridor on the property are spectacular, albeit limited by the narrowness of the view corridor. What makes the view particularly noteworthy in this location is the variety of features of the coastline that one can see. It includes the cove, beach, sea stacks, coastal bluffs, terraces, and the open ocean. And I'll show you some slides in a few minutes. The garage, which is proposed for development within the existing view corridor, would block approximately 20 feet or one-third of the coastal view shed that is currently available to the public from the highway at its narrowest point. From a point just north of Iverson Point, which is approximately a quarter mile to the north of the project site, to the community of Anchor Bay, approximately 5 miles to the south, views from the highway to the ocean are largely obstructed by existing trees, and the prevalence of trees and their effects on the coastal views in this is reflected in notes on the land use plan maps for this stretch of the shoreline that call for tree removal along much of this section of the coast. The policies call for the removal of or thinning of trees in such areas as conditions of permit approval of development. Views from the ocean are limited to various openings in the trees, usually for relatively short distances. In addition to being relatively narrow, these existing view corridors are also relatively widely spaced, leaving long stretches where the traveling public is afforded virtually no view of the ocean. Therefore, the view corridors that currently exist along the stretch of the highway provide windows to the ocean for highway travelers and are particularly valuable. Therefore, because the already narrow existing view corridor would be reduced in width by approximately a third, and because the view corridor provides one of the limited coastal view opportunities along this tree-shrouded section of Highway 1, and because the view corridor is within a designated highly scenic area that provides particularly noteworthy views, development of the proposed garage would not protect views to and along the ocean and scenic coastal areas as is required by the LCP. Development of the proposed garage would also be inconsistent with the geologic hazard policies of the LCP, which require that new structures be set back a sufficient distance from bluff edges to ensure their safety from bluff erosion and retreat during their economic lifespan of 75 years, and that new development minimize risk to life and property in areas of high geologic hazards, assure structural integrity and stability, and neither create nor contribute significantly to erosion or engender the need for protective devices. The proposed garage lies immediately adjacent to the recommended geologic setback line of 33 feet from a terrace ground crack that was mapped by the applicant's geologist and was used as the effective bluff edge from which the geologist measured the recommended setback distance. However, the commission's geologist, Dr. Johnson, reviewed the applicant's geotechnical report and determined that an additional 10 feet of setback distance is necessary for a total geologic setback of 43 feet from the terrace ground crack in order to ensure the structure's safety from bluff erosion and cliff retreat during its economic lifespan, as is required by the LCP. And Dr. Johnson's here today to go into more detail on this if necessary, but typically the development setback line to assure safety from marginally stable slopes is simply the line corresponding to a factor of safety of 1.5 as determined by a slope stability analysis of the site. The applicant's geotechnical evaluation did not include a slope stability analysis, although one was requested by staff for the purpose of the project's de novo review. Because the applicant's recommended geologic setback, which was based primarily on aerial photo analysis, lacks the stronger assurance afforded by a setback derived from the slope stability analysis and a factor of safety determination that takes into account the strengths of rocks and soils on the site and various other factors, Dr. Johnson believes that it's necessary to increase the recommended geologic setback from the terrace ground crack in order to build in a margin of error for an establishment of a safe setback. And at this particular site, Dr. Johnson believes that 10 additional feet of setback from the ground crack is the minimum distance necessary to ensure the project's consistency with the LCP geologic hazard policies. Therefore, the garage would need to be sited at least 43 feet from the bluff edge rather than 33 feet as proposed by the applicants in order to be consistent with the geologic hazard policies of the LCP. However, in addition to these visual and geologic hazard policies, inconsistencies with these policies, the proposed garage also conflicts with certain setback requirements of the Coastal Zoning Code. Development at the property is subject to a 40-foot-wide highway corridor preservation setback measured from the center line of the highway and an additional 20-foot-wide front yard setback. A variance from the county is needed to allow a reduction in the prescribed setbacks, and the proposed garage encroaches into the front yard setback by about 10 feet. It's not possible to shift the garage westward to bring it out of the front yard setback due to the geologic setback issue, which requires that it would be need to be shifted eastward. So for all of the reasons discussed, the proposed garage would be inconsistent with the visual resource protection policies of the LCP, the geologic hazard policies of the LCP, and the setback policies of the Coastal Zoning Code. Therefore, staff recommends that the commission attach special condition number one, which would require the applicants to submit a revised site plan to the executive director showing the garage addition deleted from the proposed plan. Special condition number one also would require the revised site plan to show the storage shed shifted westward approximately 5 feet so as to be outside of the front yard setback area. And special condition number two requires the shed to be maintained in colors that match or blend with the colors of the existing house and places restrictions on exterior lighting to minimize lighting impacts of the structure in this highly scenic area. So I have some slides to show to illustrate some of the visual issues raised by the project. This is just a view from the end of Iverson Point Road showing the Iverson Landing, Island Cove. This is the project setting. It's a bluff top lot and. I've got the mouse pointer. This is fine. I believe this is the Nelson's house here. It sits atop this steep bluff. Here's a view of part of the existing house and the proposed garage site from the highway. And the garage is proposed for the north side of the house within the existing public view corridor. This is another view of the proposed garage site showing some of the scenic coastal features such as the coastal terrace and sea stacks, as well as views to the open ocean that would be obstructed or partially obstructed by development of the garage. Here's a closer view taken from just outside the fence property line with a zoom lens of the same scenic coastal area that would be blocked, at least in part, by the proposed garage. And I should mention that this stretch of Highway 1, although it does not harbor sidewalks or bike lanes or a significant shoulder, is nonetheless part of the Pacific Bikeway, which extends from Canada to Mexico, and currently is designated as part of the California Coastal Trail. So although the majority of public passing by this site are motorists, the enjoyment of this view corridor by bikers and pedestrians must be considered as well. And here's a site plan showing the existing house, and here's the proposed garage, and the highway center line is up here. This is Exhibit 4 in the staff report. This bold line going across here is the 40-foot highway corridor preservation setback line, and the second bold line here is the additional 20-foot front yard setback line. And as proposed, the garage crosses into the front yard setback by about 10 feet. The terrace ground crack is down here. The proposed garage is sited 33 feet from the terrace ground crack. Dr. Johnson believes it should be at least 43 feet. The applicants did discuss a couple of alternative sitings for the garage. First, let me show, this is the public view corridor. It's from travelers along State Highway 1. They have views out to the ocean and scenic coastal areas through here. And so the applicants proposed an alternative detached garage in this area, which would raise the same visual resource protection issues just discussed. And they also discussed an alternative here, which would not be feasible due to the geologic hazard concerns. So that concludes the slideshow. In conclusion, staff believes that the proposed project, as conditioned, is consistent with the visual resource protection policies of the certified LCP and the public access policies of the Coastal Act. We also believe that the project, as conditioned, is consistent with all other LCP policies, and we recommend that you adopt the staff recommendation. The motion for approval with conditions can be found on pages 5 to 6. That concludes my remarks.
Ms. Kramer, for a new analyst, you did a very excellent job today.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, with that, we'll go to the commission for ex parties, starting on my left. No ex parties. Okay. We'll open the public hearing, and the applicant, Robert Nelson, Mr. Nelson, and I see Pamela Nelson, I assume that your wife is here too. How much time are you requesting, sir?
I believe I'm allowed 15 minutes, but I don't think I'll come close to that.
You and your wife together are allowed 15 minutes.
Thank you.
Together. So you're going to take the whole 15 minutes?
That rarely happens at home.
Your wife's not going to be too mad at you if you take all of it and then we...
No, okay. she'll be very happy. Thank you.
We'll give you 15 minutes for the two of you, and so you can turn it over to her whatever time, and then you're responsible, and I'm not in trouble.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Bob Nelson, the applicant, along with my wife, Pamela Nelson. We live at 30150 South Highway 1, right on the coast. We love the coast. The staff has raised three concerns regarding our request for the garage permit, and they are the view, the need for county variance, and a bluff setback. First, I'd like to speak about the view. Now, the county found the effect on the view to be insubstantial, and with good reason. The garage would not affect the view coming from the south. From the north and directly in front of the house, there would be only minor change in the view from a moving car. Bicyclists we have watched there never look over. They're more worried about being run over by a vehicle. If you would please look at photo number one that we passed out today. I'm afraid we don't have PowerPoint. We were lucky to be able to copy pictures. So.
Mr. Nelson, while you're pausing, I suggest maybe as part of your 15 minutes, you should reserve a couple minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Too. So maybe you want to stop at 13 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay.
The view will... Is this on?
Yes.
The view would actually be improved by this project. The project opens up over 70 additional feet of ocean view by removing small trees, severely pruning wax birtles, and removing limbs from many large Bishop pines. As a good faith gesture, we have gone ahead and done this work, as you can see in photos 2 and 3. As part of this approval, we would agree to a deed restriction to maintain this newly opened view in perpetuity. We feel that this would balance off any problems that might be caused by some loss of a small area of view. I also would like to point out that north of this area, north of Iverson Point, to Point Arena, which is approximately 5 miles, is all open to the ocean, including newly opened areas for people to pull over and enjoy the view safely. We understand that the LCP is the standard, and our proposed garage is consistent with the LCP. The LCP calls for development in this area to be subordinate to the natural setting. The garage complies. It is sited adjacent to the house and uses materials and colors that blend with the setting. We can screen it with vegetation if the commission so desires. The LCP says to minimize reflective surfaces in the scenic areas. Our two shiny white vehicles parked on a concrete pad are now in the foreground of the ocean view, as you can see in photo 4, which I think is on the back side of that page. This reflective distraction will be gone when the garage is built. The LCP height limit in our area is 18 feet. Our plans are for a 15 feet maximum, sloping down to 10 feet. And by the way, there are no views of the beach or tide pools from this area. The picture you had from Iverson Point was a lovely picture of the cove, but that's not what you see from the highway passing our house. The second issue is the variance. The county apparently overlooked the slight intrusion into the required setback. This is usually handled with a variance, and our informal discussion with county planning staff indicates that getting a variance shouldn't be a problem because of the unusual lot configuration. The third issue is the bluff setback. Excuse me. On this issue, too, our project is fully consistent with the LCP. Now, staff's recommendation is based on a rejection of methodology that has been approved by the commission in certifying the LCP, and even though the LCP is supposed to be the standard. Staff recommendation is also based on concerns over safety and bluff stability issues that do not apply in this case. One important fact to remember is that we are positioned in a cove, and there's no wave action at the base of the bluff to threaten structures above, so there's no potential need for protective work at the foot of the bluff. Farther up the bluff, there are no prospects for protective structures either. A deed restriction on our house requires that we remove the house if it is damaged by erosion, and the county put a similar restriction on our garage. We would expect the commission to do the same. The LCP policies cited in the staff report all reflect these concerns about safety and bluff stability, but they just aren't relevant here. Even so, we have obtained a geologic evaluation, one that complied with the requirements of the LCP. And our geologist, Jim Glum, used the setback formula required by the LCP, which is the retreat rate times 75 years. He concluded that the garage can be safely built. He also advised us, based on aerial photos, that the bluff has been stable over many years. And we have reports from 1980, 2002, and 2007 that document stability. The staff report admiringly discusses a different setback methodology, the factor of safety approach, based on quantitative slope stability analysis. Because this approach was not used, staff recommends an additional 10-foot setback in order to build in a margin of error for safe setback. We believe there are several things wrong with this. First, it's not what the LCP prescribes. Also, it is not necessary. I believe that Dr. Johnson, who is here, described the Glom setback recommendations as conservative. And it is based on concerns about safety. And as I've noted, those don't apply to this project. This is a garage. It's not a house. And we would expect to remove it if it were damaged by bluff erosion. It is in our own interest to do that. In conclusion, let me first thank the staff who have always been polite and forthcoming and always available to us. I think it really, I'm glad that they work for us. That's a general us. In conclusion, I just want to say that our garage project is consistent with the LCP and would actually improve the visual qualities in that area. And we therefore respectfully request that you grant permission to build our garage. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And we'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal time. How's that? Okay. Does your wife want to say anything? No? He said it all. Okay. Thank you. Julie Veron? How much time, ma'am, are you requesting?
Oh, 5 minutes, but I probably won't use it.
5 minutes, yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I represent Friends of Schooner Gulch. This is a small group that used to be much larger. We used to have 900 members, but we don't now. We do have a board. I am the field representative, and I'm not a board member. The person who wrote the appeal is not here, and so I'm not as up to it as if I'd written the appeal, but I think the staff analysis is excellent, and I urge you to support staff. It's factual, and it's also equitable, because they are allowed to do the shed and the berm that they've already done. Friends of Schooner Gulch board and field representative among us have lived on this stretch of the coast or been very familiar with it for a total of about 150 years. We're all old coast hands, and we have observed the geological hazards in operation. And Dr. Johnson has also been looking at these geological hazards for some years now, and I think that is the key reason why they should not be allowed to build the garage where they plan to. That plus the height of the garage, 16 feet is kind of high for a garage. But also, if you've got a crack, if your geologist finds a crack, you really have to back off. And only just a short distance to the northwest of this proposed garage, there have been several really extreme instances of bluff retreat that have threatened the highway, and the whole highway had to be moved inland. And the fact that they have done vegetation removal and limbed up trees, this means that there will be more water going into the geologically unstable area, and it also means that there may be removal of the roots. Roots of the remaining trees may be torn up due to wind throw. So we agree with staff and would like to add those geological cautions, and we also particularly agree with Dr. Johnson. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Moran. Yes, sir. Mr. Nelson.
When we originally had planned the remodel in our house and a garage also, it was opposed by the Friends of Schooner Gulch. We removed the garage requirement in order to be able to build a house because I was retiring from my practice in 2005. The reason that Schooner Gulch, the Friends of Schooner Gulch opposed it was because of the view. But what they proposed was opening up the same view corridor I just spoke about. And I would ask the Friends of Schooner Gulch to go back and look at the correspondence and the recommendations from their secretary, which is exactly what we've done. The problem was that they could not find anybody who would enforce this deed restriction. The county didn't want to do it. The state didn't want to do it. And so this agreement fell apart. Thank you. Oh, one other thing. As far as erosion on the surface, we have put in drains. The drains go into naturally drainage areas that are even used by the state for their culvert system. And so there is no erosion problem on the surface. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Nelson. I'll close the public hearing and go back to staff. Ms. Kramer, do you have any comments?
Yeah, I just have a couple of comments, and then I'll turn it over to Dr. Johnson to address the geologic issues. But Dr. Nelson mentions the view just a half mile or so north of his house that is very extensive for miles and miles. And we would just say to that we, even though there are open views up to the north, we have to consider cumulative impacts, and every little piece of the view shed counts, and under the LCP is required to be protected in this highly scenic area. And then as to the view blockage from the existing cars that are parked on the car pad, the view blockage from those cars only occurs when the cars are present, and the amount of view blocked by the cars is relatively small in comparison with the amount of view that would be permanently blocked by the proposed permanent 20-foot-long garage. And I think I'll just turn it over to Dr. Johnson now.
Thank you, Ms. Kramer. Chairman, commissioners, I just want to very briefly elaborate a little bit on the reason that I'm recommending an additional 10-foot setback in addition to what it was proposed by the project geologist. Section 20500010 of the LCP has language mirroring Section 30253 of the Coastal Act, which says that, which requires that the development minimize risk to life and property in areas of high geologic flood and fire hazard and assure structural integrity and stability. Staff's interpretation and your interpretation and many actions of this language has meant that with respect to slope stability, that the development is cited such that there will be a factor of safety of 1.5 for the economic life of the development. We normally try to evaluate that by a quantitative slope stability analysis in conjunction with the expected erosion over the life of the development. In this case, a slope stability analysis was not performed, but the geologist's estimate of the amount of retreat of the bluff edge over the next 75 years was 33 feet, which coincidentally happens to be exactly where the garage is proposed. In other words, at the end of 75 years, the garage's foundations would be beginning to be undermined. They certainly would not be stable at that time. The 10-foot setback buffer, in addition to that, serves a number of purposes. One is for any uncertainty in the analyses. Two is for any increase in bluff retreat that we might expect over the next 75 years. Remember that this 33-foot setback was arrived at by looking at previous bluff retreat rates. Increase in bluff retreat rate might be expected in light of future sea level rise. Third, it allows room for access to the site, and the reason that 10 feet is the minimum that can usually be, that in this case would be acceptable, is because that's typically what number that is given to us when we ask how much access freeway there must be for to bring the equipment in around the site. So for all of those reasons, we believe that it's necessary under the section of the LCP to have an additional 10 feet over the expected retreat over the life of the development. And I can go into more detail if you have any questions. Thank you.
That completes the staff comments.
Thank you for the excellent presentation. I'll go to Vice Chair Neely, then Commissioner Secord.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Commission approve Coastal Development Permit number A-1-MEN-07-003, subject to the conditions, and recommend a yes vote.
Second. It's been moved by Vice Chair Neely, seconded by Commissioner Wan. They're asking the maker and seconder for a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the approval of the permit as condition and adoption of the following resolutions and findings. You would like to speak to your motion, Vice Chair Neely?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just that I agree with the staff's analysis on this one. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Wan, anything?
I know.
Oh, yeah.
Second.
You were the seconder, but I stand corrected.
Okay. No, you're right, Commissioner Crew, as usual. I had only one comment and question of staff about something that I would like added in, and that is there's no prohibition on the use of invasive species, which is something that we should be including in our staff reports. And unless commissioners object, I would ask that that provision be included.
So that any landscaping that's added use native vegetation?
Well, generally speaking, we don't require it to be native, but we at least prohibit the use of invasives.
Right.
There's a distinction. They can plant non-natives as long as they're not invasive. Okay.
Okay.
Well, the maker of the motion, is that okay with the maker of the motion?
Yes.
Okay. Commissioner Secord?
Minor question of the applicant. Could you stand up, Doctor?
Yes, sir.
If you decided you're going to use the existing garage pad, which is the thing you park on today, as the floor of this garage, is that your intention?
That's correct.
And second question is, if you built a carport which didn't have walls, couldn't you cover your vehicles and still provide the view that is there today when the cars were not present?
It depends on how the carport would be, and I don't know whether or not we're allowed to put any kind of supports, you know, within 43 feet, as Dr. Johnson said. The van will continue to be there. It's about six and a half feet high, so I don't know that the view is a problem, and I'm not quite sure. I'm not a geologist, sir. I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a semi-retired doc, but I don't know why the geologists choose 20 feet rather than 40 feet or a half a foot. I know that there's probably some technical reason for that. I also want to say that as far as a quantitative slope analysis, Dr. Johnson, according to the report from staff, felt it was not necessary. I did not get a report from Dr. Johnson. All I got was secondhand information from the staff report.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to amend Condition 1, to delete the requirement that the garage be deleted, and to require the applicant to submit plans to the executive director that would show an open-sided carport no closer to the geological hazard than 33 feet, and evidence of a setback variance from the county in order to get a permit.
Second.
Can I, in discussing this, staff, can we see the picture of the geological hazard and the setbacks and stuff that we had up previously? Can we pull that back up? Let me say while we're doing this that I'm familiar with this area, and there are broad plain spectrums immediately north here where you have pullouts and you can actually park your car and look and stuff like that. This really is an area of Highway 1 that's on a pretty sharp turn, and there's a very brief view coming south. I'm not sure at at the speed that people go there at 50 or 55 miles an hour. It's that safe to have an attractive view shed there, but even with a garage that would be there, there's still over 40 feet of view shed that's being maintained there and stuff, and I think we take that in Malibu. I don't know if the same things apply to Mendocino or not, but it's not a huge view shed because of the shape of the road and the way it goes there.
Commissioner
that's
Riley?
I was looking for...
Did you say that your motion is to permit a open carport?
Yeah, okay. At the 33-foot level.
So we need the diagram, the map.
Well, you already have a requirement they resubmit
right.
to you, so that goes to you. But there's one picture here. That's the one. Now, unless I'm seeing things, it looks to me as though, with Dr. Johnson's determination, as though the house is well within your geological hazard area. And the house also extends into the front yard setback area.
That's correct. The house is in an area where I would not recommend it be built today.
Now, the county has a condition that if it does become unstable, that they have to move it, right?
Yes, there's a condition on the house that they're not allowed to build a bluff protection device.
Did they put the same condition on the potential garage?
The county, in its approval of the garage, yes.
So basically,
they
have to move their house if the bluff retreats. And from my perspective, that's adequate protection for us as long as we don't have armament there. So I would ask for. I would ask for support for that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Riley. Commissioner Wanick?
Commissioner Riley, I have a question. If you're going to ask for that area to allow a carport in it, he has opened up voluntarily another section by cutting trees. Can we require that be maintained?
I would maintain the same deed restrictions that he offered. I'm not proposing to change those deed restrictions.
So you're not going to require that that area be maintained?
Yeah, that is the deed restriction.
Is that in the current deed restriction? Are those areas, staff? The current deed restrictions that are placed on it, the area that he opened up that's in addition to where the carport or the garage was proposed, are those areas required to be maintained open?
The county staff report, the county permit, which was issued and then which was appealed, did have a deed restriction requiring them to maintain that view corridor, but that was appealed.
So that's incorporated into our.
I think you just incorporated it into your motion.
Okay.
That's what I was asking.
Yes,
that's
fine.
Have that incorporated.
That's fine.
Okay. That's okay. The way we understand.
Is that fine with the seconder of the motion, Commissioner Secord?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Is there any reason for a roll call vote on this? Commissioner Schallenberger.
Just so I'm sure I understand what's being suggested here, can we go back to the earlier slide that showed the pictures of the current shiny white car? Yeah. The one before that or after? Yeah. Now, Commissioner Riley, are you suggesting when a carport means to me no walls but a covered area?
That's right.
From this area,
you might have a pole in the middle or something like that.
Or the four sides or something like that. Yeah. It seems to me from here, this view, if that car were covered, that it would significantly impact the view shed from where this photograph's taken.
Well, I'm not sure where somebody stood to get that picture, but they probably were pretty close to the middle of the road there.
That's the fence in the front, the applicant's fence line. So it was right on the edge of the road, basically,
yeah,
between the fog line and the fence line. So,
well, I bring it up only because this argument that we hear it all the time, not so much in the commission, but I used to hear it when I worked in the legislature and people complained about what the commission was doing, and that is that bicyclists, that cars are going 60 miles an hour and they don't you know, glance over and see it, and the bicyclists are paying attention to what they're doing. This is a very common argument, and so it's not, to me, it's not a valid argument for blocking off a view shed, and that's what I'm trying to get at. Is this? It seems to me that a carport there would block the view shed for bicyclists, and
I would say that's a judgment call, yeah. Commissioner.
It is a judgment call, and I'm just asking your judgment. You think it would not?
I think it's minimal, and I think that the fact that they've opened up the other 40 feet of view and stuff compensates for that in that particular location.
Yeah. Mr. Riley, I guess I have one question on the amendment, and that is that I don't, from my perspective, when I look at that, and I think your idea is a good one, but what comes to mind is the design, what type of roof, how high it is, where it places makes a big difference on the view shed, even through a carport. I could, whether it's a hip roof, a flat roof, and how tall it is, et cetera. And I just wonder, and I understand your amendment, but
Executive Director has a comment, I thought.
Yeah.
I think the condition as it is would require a redesign submitted to the executive director for review and approval, and then we would look at it and see whether it minimizes the visual impact. But, you know,
that's fine.
Your motion would allow a carport, and we would want to make sure that it's designed in a way to minimize the visual impact.
That would be fine with me because I could design a carport where you'd have very little visual, and I could design one that you would be greatly blocked.
So
and
could
still
I.
Be a call. Okay.
And they're also with.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd just like to comment on Commissioner Riley's amendment. I think it's both reasoned and I think appropriate in this case. So yeah. I support it.
Is there any objection to unanimous roll call vote on the amending motion, Commissioner Riley's motion? Is there any objection to a unanimous yes approval of it? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. Okay, and now the main motion. The main motion, the maker and seconder are asking for a yes vote. And again, passage of this motion will result in the approval of the permit as condition and adopt the following resolutions and findings as contained in the staff report. Commissioner Wan.
Since we had so much discussion, I want to just sort of clarify what it is that we did. We've got the invasive species condition. We've got the inclusion of the deed restriction, keeping the area open. And we have allowing the carport at the area that, 43 feet back?
No, at the area that he, that the applicant.
Okay, at the 33 for. Feet, but that's that right. The design will come to you for your review and approval for visual impacts.
So it minimizes visual impacts.
Okay, I just wanted to get it straight what we were voting on.
Any objection to unanimous yes roll call vote on this? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. The commission hereby approves a coastal development permit for the proposed development and adopts the findings set forth in the staff report. Okay? Is there any other items? I think that was the last one because 12D was postponed and
no
public comment.
Then no, we have no. We have one more item, Mr. Chairman,
and we have one public comment speaker.
Right, but this item deals with the indemnification clause issue, and as you recall, at the last meeting, there was considerable discussion about the history and the legal basis for and the policy implications of attaching indemnification conditions to projects before the commission. And there was some discussion about the potential of having a subcommittee of the commission to look into that issue. The commission did not direct us to do that. Instead, when I responded, I indicated that we would be prepared to make a brief presentation on what the history and legal basis is for that indemnification condition. And so we are prepared to do that. We have legal staff here to give you a brief overview. But let me just indicate to you that I have, as a matter of policy, direction to the staff indicated that we're not going to attach that condition or recommend that it be used in a single-family home applications. So that's just a position that we've taken at the staff level.
With that, let me turn it over to legal counsel.
Commissioner Blank has a question before we start.
I guess to the chair, this is just a matter of question or procedure. I thought last month, and obviously we're here again so we get to ask the question again, that the question of a subcommittee was on the table. I don't know the procedure for having the commissioners discuss it. I really do appreciate the director's comment on the record about no indemnification on single-family homes. I'm very interested in the legal comments, but the issue raised in the public hearing and others in closed session now makes me really even more interested about when we perhaps should use indemnification for not single-family homes, and I think it's a broad issue that ought to be addressed by the commissioners themselves in a subcommittee that talk about indemnification. I really think the legal input from the staff would be helpful, but I think this is coming up almost in every hearing in what should we and should we do. I've heard from Commissioner Wan her opinions, and I know others have others, and I know I think these are serious impacts on our budget if we lose. And I've heard you raise that issue, and I understand it. I'm sympathetic to it. As you know, my opinion on single-family homes, I'm sympathetic to that. But I would hate to see us a year from now only left with you because we got rid of the rest of our budget and lost it in lawsuits. So I don't know what the process is, Mr. Chairman, but I'd like to still suggest a subcommittee for indemnification.
Well,
sorry.
I think that the way we left it last time, that we were going to hear from the staff and let them make their presentation, and it's still on the table whether or not that we, the suggestion you made that some, if not the majority, would like to have a subcommittee on this. I don't know what the outcome of that is, but I think we need to hear from them. A presentation first would be the proper procedure, and then you can talk about the subcommittee and others can, whether we decide today.
And do we vote on that? Is that the procedure for a subcommittee?
Yeah, you can, if there's a majority that wants a subcommittee,
great.
we could establish a subcommittee.
Thank you.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, I think historically the chair has had the authority to establish and appoint subcommittees without a formal vote of the commission.
That is correct, and thank you, Commissioner Riley. I think that the way we left it, and I have just as one commissioner like the rest of you, I think it's fair to follow the procedure that we were going to listen to staff and staff's counsel first, and then we might just make the allocate the subcommittee. I'd like to hear what the commissioners have to say on that. Okay, with that, legal staff and staff, who's going to start?
Thank you, Chair Kaur. I am very happy to introduce Staff Counsel Louise Warren. She is our newest attorney. She's been with us for 6 months, half a year now. We're enthusiastically happy with the work that she's been doing for us, primarily advising the San Diego and South Coast districts. She has prepared a presentation regarding the indemnification condition. So with that, I'll hand it over to her.
Thank you. The primary legal authority that enables the Coastal Commission to include indemnity provisions in coastal development permits is found in Section 30620 of the Coastal Act. It allows the Commission to require reimbursement of expenses for the processing of CDPs. In addition, the regulation Section 13055E allows the Commission to seek reimbursement for its reasonable fees incurred in its consideration of permits. Based on the plain language of 30620, the Commission does have the authority to include indemnity provisions. First of all, attorney's fees are expenses that are incurred by the Commission. In addition, the language of sections 30620 and 13055 allow for reimbursement of expenses. The use of the word reimbursement suggests that the legislature anticipated the Commission would seek to recover expenses after they had been incurred. If the legislature was only authorizing the Commission to recover expenses for administrative costs, it would not have needed to allow for the reimbursement of expenses. Attorney's fees are this type of expense that can only be recovered after they have been incurred. Finally, attorney's fees are expenses that are incurred for processing and considering permit applications. Reimbursement is only sought for attorney's fees that are incurred as the result of approving a permit. The fees are therefore not only related to but dependent upon approval of CDPs. Thanks. If the commission loses a case, courts typically remand the permit for further consideration. Attorney's fees are thus incurred as part of the whole permitting process. I know that there were some concerns raised at the prior commission meeting about the authority of the commission to impose these conditions. And the primary flaw with the arguments raised by the applicants is that they failed to distinguish between fees on the one hand and expenses. Section 30620 explicitly allows the commission to recover reasonable filing fees and the reimbursement of expenses. Each provision of a statute must be given meaning, and if the legislature had only intended for the commission to be able to recover its administrative costs, it would not have needed to include the section allowing for reimbursement of expenses. I believe the applicants also argued that Section 13055G supported their contention that the commission could only recover administrative costs because it states that fees must be paid in full when the application is filed. Again, Section 13055 makes a distinction between fees and expenses, and 13055G relates only to fees. And under 13055E, we are allowed to recover expenses. So the language in 13055G is simply not relevant in this context. Finally, they argued that Section 30607 only allows conditions that are consistent with Chapter 3, and 30620 is not found in Chapter 3. This is based on a misreading of 30607 that actually allows for conditions to be added to permits that are consistent with the Coastal Act as a whole. Had the legislature intended it to mean only consistent with Chapter 3, it would have said so. Instead, it said the Coastal Act as a whole. Besides which, the main authority for adding these conditions is found in 30620, not based on 30607. We understand that a number of local governments include indemnity provisions, so we conducted a very informal survey of six different county councils, mostly based on who had returned phone calls. Monterey County includes indemnity provisions in every one of their discretionary permits. It's a condition of approval in every permit out of Monterey County. San Luis Obispo includes them in any permit where the county perceives that there is a high probability of litigation. San Diego and Santa Cruz have fairly similar programs. There are some slight tweaks, but the same idea where there's the potential for litigation, they include indemnity provisions. In Sonoma County, each applicant is required to enter into an indemnity provision. So it goes not only onto every permit, but every application that is submitted to the county includes an indemnity provision. And the basis for that is a public policy reason. The county has determined that by including the indemnity provision, the applicant then has this an incentive to ensure that the approval is compliant with applicable law. The basis for the authority for local governments to impose these conditions is their police powers, which are found in Article 11, Section 7 of the Constitution. These powers are typically interpreted fairly broadly. The case that's most on point is an unpublished case called California Biomass versus the City of San Bernardino. In that case, the court held that a local government could include an indemnity provision on a conditional use permit. Its reasoning basically looked at the fact that courts have upheld various types of regulations, various types of fees, that include regulatory fees to cover the cost of permits. Courts have looked at what types of fees cover the cost of permits and have interpreted that very broadly, that the recoverable costs include those incident to the issuance of the license or permit, and that the fees are properly determined with a view to reimbursing the local government for all expenses imposed on it, which include all the incidental costs to a local government that it may be likely to incur as a result of issuing the permit. So based on that, the court concluded that If litigation or expenses are incurred in defending the validity of the permit, the local government is entitled to determine that the permit holder should bear these costs. And the court relied heavily on an opinion from the Attorney General issued in 2002 that essentially laid out the analysis that the court adopted, that because courts have interpreted costs related to permits quite broadly, attorney's fees could be included in the instance of the Attorney General opinion. Indemnity provisions could be included on coastal development permits. Now, while the basis of the authority for local governments to impose these conditions is different, through 30620, the legislature has given the commission the same authority to seek reimbursement for attorney's fees that local governments may exercise through police powers. Section 30620 explicitly allows the commission to require reimbursement for expenses it incurs as a result of processing permits. Courts have interpreted expenses associated with permits broadly. Therefore, attorney's fees are included within the scope of 30620. I also wanted to give you a very brief overview of how the indemnity provision would work. It would only be triggered if the commission is sued by a third party, not by the applicant themselves. The commission is currently not billed by the Attorney General for their representation, so the recoverable costs would not include the commission's own defense fees. What was that?
Attorney General's changed his policy.
Not that I'm aware.
No. We don't charge for our representation of the commission.
Okay, gotcha.
So our defense costs would then not be passed on to the applicant. In addition, we'd have to lose the case in order for the applicant to be liable for these fees. And not only would we have to lose the case, but the plaintiff would have to qualify as a private attorney general. And the basis of the private attorney general theory is basically that the plaintiff has brought a case that results in the enforcement of an important right affecting the public interest. So, for example, if a next-door neighbor sued because the commission approved a house and the neighbor said it blocked their visual view of the ocean, that would not be a case where a court would conclude that the attorney's fees could be recovered. And just to give you a quick sense of how this has impacted the commission in the past, since 1996, the commission has paid or will pay a total of $334,000 in attorney's fees. The majority of that has come in the last year through the Lewis case, which was $160,000, and Chris will maybe talk about this a little more, but in the Bisc case, we're also responsible for $60,000. So between 1996 and 1999, we only spent $114,000. That concludes my presentation.
I have a quick question. Can I, sure. Before, can we get a copy of this? I thought this was an excellent summary.
Thanks.
I disagree with it, but I thought it was, and now's not the time, but I thought it would just be excellent to have the rest of the commissioners read this, because I think it is relevant to a much longer discussion. But
and
I thought it was
and
great
of course, idea. Our... presentation and all discussion here is captured on DVD, so it's in our archive. You can access that anytime.
Got
so.
It. Thank you.
We'll continue that, but the question was, what was that amount over all those years? That's all it was? And, you know?
We actually only have the records going back to 1996 for a variety of reasons. We've looked for the earlier amounts but weren't able to find them. Since 1996, we've spent $334,000 approximately on attorney's fees, but $220,000 of that has been in the last year and a half. $334,000.
Okay. I thought the number would be a lot higher, that there was a huge crisis here.
Well, the problem is that the numbers are going up.
And the problem is that there's no budget for it.
Right.
Thank you very much, Luis, for your presentation. Just this morning, we received some news regarding an attorney fees motion in the Bisc case. This is regarding the Bisc project in Channel Islands Harbor. where the commission was sued and the trial court ruled against the commission. This morning, the trial court granted a motion for $130,000 in attorney's fees. That will be split between the county and the commission. The commission will be bearing $60,000 of that amount. The petitioner in that case had actually sought more than $200,000 in attorney's fees, so fortunately the court did not grant the entire amount they requested, but I just wanted to pass that news along to you.
Okay, can I ask a question of clarification here? Maybe historical in nature, but I know as a local government official, we budget for attorney fees. I mean, we expect and we do get sued, not as much as Commissioner Potter in Monterey, but we get sued. But I don't understand this. The executive director's comment that we don't budget for it. Why is it that we don't budget for it? Peter?
Well, for one thing, we'd have to have the legislature approve it, and that's never been included in a budget that we've submitted or that's been approved.
But the truth of reality is it's a fact of life that we require fees to defend ourselves. So why don't we include it?
Well, I can explore that. It's a speculative amount, and I can't imagine the legislature approving a speculative budget item for us.
Well, but wait. I would not characterize it as speculative. The way we do it at local government is we do it based upon projections of past experience and history reasonably applied to the future. That's not speculation.
So, well, what you're suggesting okay. is that we ask the legislature to budget an amount which now, based on the last year and a half, would be somewhere over $100,000 for potential attorney's fees in cases that we lose. I'm not sure that's an appropriate thing to ask the legislature to do. What we have done in the past is when we've had such a big award, we've gone back to the legislature and asked for a supplemental appropriation to cover the costs, and we've been asked questions like, why did you lose? Did you follow the Attorney General's advice? Was it something that had a justification for your position? And we've been successful in virtually every instance that I can recall in getting some supplemental appropriation when we've asked for it.
And quite frankly, to me, that's the reactive approach versus the proactive approach to this phenomena. I mean, the phenomena is there. I would support at least further study and consideration of a proactive approach on this.
Mr. Schallenberger.
It's actually the more common approach in the state legislature is the reactive, the supplemental appropriation, and the one that happens every single year is firefighting. There's this very small, within CDF, a very small budget in relation to what the actual cost of firefighting. At the end of the fire year, they come back with a supplemental appropriation, which is to cover the actual cost of firefighting. I would suggest that if we want to go down this route, that we shouldn't be standing alone with this, that it perhaps a meeting to figure out within the resources agency. I believe that this is true of all of our resources agencies, and I mean all of the departments in the resources agency, and maybe even within CalEPA, and figure out what is the burden for other departments and other agencies. And I think the odds politically of the Coastal Commission doing a standalone, we ought to have our attorney's fees covered, is very slim. In order to form a real policy based with other resource agencies and what their attorney's costs are, might be stronger. But I do think it would be based on a supplemental real cost rather than.
I'm not adverse to your suggestion, Mary, on that.
Commissioner Wan.
We're in a slightly different situation than some of the other resource agencies, and I'm wondering what the likelihood is of litigation against some of these other agencies. So which agencies are you referring to?
I'm referring to all the ones that issue permits that, if they deny or amend a permit, can get sued and overturned. I'm assuming, I looked at the AG, isn't this, Fish and Game have similar issues? State Water Resources Control Board, Air Resources Board, they get sued for issuing or not issuing permits?
Well, we can certainly explore the suggestion and report back to you what we find out.
Commissioner Bryan.
I will do that.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman, given the issues raised today, I think it's even bigger than I thought. I thought the legal analysis was interesting, though I just want to point out that Section 30620 and the analysis just kind of assumes that the extension of the thought is that these fees are reasonable if we extend the notion that this is part of processing an application. That is, that's what 30620 and the coastal regs talk about. I think it's a wonderful conversation to continue. Obviously, it will depend on our legal staff's analysis. We'd love to meet with them. I think Commissioner Schallenberg had a great idea that there are other agencies that probably have gone through this as well. I think the legal staff, again, raised a great legal argument about police powers that are chartered by the state constitution versus what our powers are because we're chartered by statute. I think we should have a subcommittee, and I'm asking you to appoint one that meets with our council, meets with other agencies, meets with staff, and comes up with a policy for this commission on indemnification.
I'd like to see from the commissioners, and I know there's with people with travel times, et cetera, today, I'd like to get a sense of how many people would like to see a subcommittee which wouldn't set the policy but do some of the work and then come back to the commission of whole is going to have to set whatever policy working with staff on this. How many people would be in favor of looking into these issues as a subcommittee at the subcommittee level? Just raise your hand. I'm trying to get a sense of commission.
Mr. There. Chairman?
Yeah.
Before you do that, can I make some comments?
Well, I'll let
I mean,
you
as long as you don't formally do this before you hear comments, because I strongly object to,
okay.
to doing this.
We will give you a chance. I'm trying to get a consensus of the commissioners now, and you can make your argument, and then we'll. Okay. Again. Okay. How many people? What?
Six.
Seven.
Okay. And. Okay, and then
majority.
How many are just opposed to having any subcommittee?
There's a middle ground here.
Well, no, I'm just trying to get a sense.
Thank you, Mary.
Okay,
I think there's a middle ground. My thought is that this isn't an issue that lends itself to subcommittee.
That's right.
I think the work needs to be done. I am worried when I hear something that a subcommittee will go off and meet with other agencies and all that kind of thing. I mean, as commissioners,
I agree with you, Commissioner Schallenberg. So I'll withdraw the meet with agencies. I'm happy to have staff meet with agencies. I think that's appropriate. Thank you.
I think it's the kind of thing that should be done as a whole. This is a huge policy. I as a commissioner, am not prepared. I'm not comfortable having two commissioners go off and work on this and come back with a recommendation because it's one of those issues that are so important that I don't want the recommendation. I want to go through the work with them. And so so that's my only thing. It's not about the work not being essential. I just don't think it's work that lends itself to a subcommittee.
Mr. Clark.
Thank you. I appreciate the perspective that Commissioner Schallenberger has, but quite frankly, I think the reality lies in bringing this back to the commission as a whole. I would rather see, and I like Commissioner Blank's suggestion that if we've got a couple of volunteer commissioners who will focus some time and effort on this and then bring it back to the whole, the fact of the matter is that the subcommittee will not be deciding for the commission, but they'll be doing the preliminary work with staff on it. And I think that's a laudable objective.
Vice Chair Neely.
Well, I think the current policy is on a case-by-case basis. There is an analysis done, and it's brought to the commission to either include or reject. And I guess I want to know how much staff time this will take in terms of the subcommittee work, and is that a priority for us now?
Well, and that's thank you for raising that point. That's exactly my concern. Subcommittees are very labor intensive, and we don't have any staff available to staff such a subcommittee. And so from my perspective, given all of the workload and the inadequate staffing level that we have, to now divert staff time to work with a subcommittee on an issue that is brought to you on a case-by-case basis and not very often raises the concern in my mind, what's the purpose? What's the objective here? And is this a legitimate use of staff time to what end? You as a commission will have to decide when we recommend an indemnification condition whether or not you think it's appropriate. So I'm really concerned about what this is going to mean in terms of staff support for any subcommittee to do what.
Commissioner Wong.
Well, that's my concern. Is the level of staff time that has to be done. If this commission has specific questions and information that it wants the staff to get to it so it as a commission can discuss this, that's appropriate. Let the staff know what issues you want. Have the staff bring that information back to all of us to discuss. But to have that staff have to go through several processes which will take up enormous amount of staff time and then still have to come back to us to have the full discussion on all of the issues, not just what some commissioners have filtered through to us, is not appropriate because we're going to have to go through it again anyway. And I don't mind having the discussion in public and having all of us in on it, but...
Commissioner Riley.
Well, I just think there are policies issues here that whether we deal with it in a subcommittee or whether we deal with it in full commission really need to be decided. I'm also cognizant of commission time spent on, you know, those selected items that staff's recommending indemnification on, and we get caught up in an extended discussion about that and debate about it too. It doesn't happen in local government because, I mean, assuming an exclusion for single-family residence applications or appeals, I think that we just ought to, if we're going to do indemnification at all, we ought to do it uniformly across the board and have it be a normal part of standard conditions, and that way it's just part of the way we do business and not something that we have to debate periodically whenever staff decides on a case-by-case basis that, you know, that it's needed. It's an equity issue, I think, that you're going to pick some and not pick other ones, and I don't think that we should be in that situation as a policy matter.
So, Commissioner Riley, what would be your preference? How do we get to that?
I think staff needs direction on it.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't take any extra staff time to put a standard condition in, you know, add another standard condition on permits that aren't involving single-family residences.
Are you suggesting a subcommittee or just a direction to the staff?
I'm suggesting a policy difference between the way staff is currently applying this and the way it should be applied.
And how do you suggest resolving that, or at least discussing?
By having the commission tell staff to do it uniformly.
Well, for one thing, right. By doing that, you're implying a regulation, and in order for this commission to adopt the regulation which says as a matter of standard practice you're going to do this, that requires going through the Office of Administrative Law regulation making proceedings. In the absence of that, it's an underground regulation and not legal. If the commission...
So it's legal in a particular case, but it's not legal across the board?
On a case-by-case basis, it is. If you do it across the board, it's in the nature of a regulation that requires a regulation-making process. Yep.
Then we should go through that process.
Yep. Commissioner Blank.
So just for the executive director, I am not suggesting the outcome of a... subcommittee is something that will go through the OLA. I am suggesting a set of guidelines for staff that, and actually for discussion, the commissioners that would allow us to understand how to make case by case findings. I just have to say, Director Douglas, I'm incredibly impressed with your ability to hold two contradictory thoughts and present them at the same time, which was the impact on staff time and the impact on our budget. So I actually have heard you several times tell us about the impact of these attorney's fees on our budgets and the potential of that increasing over time. And I think I have to weigh that with the impact on staff time. And I'm not, at least in my mind, in a subcommittee thinking about anything close to what would come out of our budget for losing these lawsuits. So at least in my mind, I could balance, using our balancing act, the two ideas and be very sensitive to staff time and still think we might do something useful for the commission.
Well, if I may, first of all, I don't think my positions there are contradictory. I'd like to know if the commission is going to set up a subcommittee on this issue of the kind of conditions that the staff is going to recommend to the commission. That's an incredible departure from 30 years of practice in this commission, so that you have a subcommittee which basically will be directing the staff on what their recommendation is. That's contrary to your regulations and your practice. I would like to know also what the specific purpose of the subcommittee would be, so that I know if the commission establishes it, what we have to look at in terms of staff time,
Mr. Chair,
and serving the subcommittee.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
Chairman Kruger.
Yes.
Over this one.
Yeah.
Can I just respond to the director's comment?
Sure.
Yeah. I don't see it, Peter, as the you portray it as potentially the subcommittee directing staff. I don't think that's the conception in mind. I think the conception in mind is that the subcommittee of the commission, and maybe it needs, if we establish a subcommittee, a set of ground rules or a very abbreviated charter of what they'll be looking at. But the subcommittee would be coming back to the commission as a whole with its results of its work and its findings and its recommendations to be discussed by the commission as a whole with staff. So I don't see Commissioner Blank suggesting we set up a subcommittee on indemnification that will have the empowerment to direct staff on the future of how we deal with indemnification. What he's suggesting is further exploratory review, analysis by a couple of members of the commission, supported by a reasonable time proportion of staff in that venture and bringing it back to the commission. I think that's a reasonable recommendation.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Yeah. Chairman.
Yes, Commissioner Riley.
I just like to ask counsel, what I heard from counsel is that there is existing law that allows us to be able to charge our expenses, including attorney's expenses, you know, to applicants in certain situations, and that that's a matter of current law. And my question is, why do we need a new regulation in order to be able to exercise our authority under the current law?
Yes, through the chair. We do believe that the Coastal Act, Section 30620, provides the commission with the authority to require reimbursements of expenses, including attorney's fees. Our regulations currently track that in very general terms of authorizing us to obtain reimbursements of expenses associated with processing CDP applications. Our regulations don't go into further detail, you know, laying out how that's applied in every situation. So the concern here would be is if the commission provides direction that in all instances fees should be collected in a certain manner, then that creates this concern about an underground regulation. An underground regulation is a rule of general applicability that applies in all circumstances that has not gone through the formal rulemaking process. So if we were to require indemnification of attorney's fees across the board, people would have this argument that that's an underground regulation because it's adding specificity to our current regulations and is applying those across the board. That is the concern.
maybe one thing we could do in terms of wrapping this up, could also look at just not using that condition, just saying, okay, we're not going to use indemnification clauses. So, in fact, I'm toying with that right now. That may be the better approach.
Well, I also think that would be a mistake. That's why I'm suggesting a set of suggestions for the commission.
Personally, right now, there's not really a consensus here, and I think in the condo hotel deal, the workshop idea worked pretty well, because when that started, I wasn't necessarily enlightened as much as Commissioner Clark was on, and there were some different viewpoints, and it worked out very well. I think we learned a lot, and it was a workshop. I'm cognizant of the pressures of time, et cetera, and also cognizant of the fact of our priorities, and facing this next month, 4.5 days or 5 days, I'm open to a subcommittee. I don't have a strong feeling that either way, but I don't think that'd be the appropriate time today to say we'd start to have a subcommittee, because we don't have the time. We could have a 6-day hearing next month, and the month after that looks really bad. But I do share, as one commissioner, my concerns of the same thing that Commissioner Riley talked about and some of the things that Commissioner Blank talked about, et cetera, of this use of this indemnity and when it's used, et cetera. So for right now, I'm not going to name a subcommittee at this month's hearing, but I am, as one member, I will be very much looking on a case-by-case basis the use of this. And if the other commissioners can convince me to do so, a subcommittee down the road, I'd be open to it. But, you know, right now we don't have our budget, we don't have enough money, we don't have enough staff, we don't have enough time. So I don't think it'd be appropriate this month to do that. I really don't. I think that life timing is everything. This would be just adding more pressure and more time to everybody. But I am cognizant of your issues, Commissioner Blank.
Chair Kruger, can I suggest we name a subcommittee and not discuss it till August, when we could put it on the agenda in something other than the last item?
I'm reluctant today, in light of the information I'm hearing from all the different commissioners and staff and everything, to name a subcommittee today.
And can I suggest this go back on the agenda in August, not as the last item?
Sure.
For further discussion?
Sure. Yeah.
Can we have it somewhere on the first or second day rather than the last item?
And again, the subcommittee, in the end, it always has to come back to the commission. And if I did name a subcommittee, I would name a person who I think has one viewpoint and one that has an opposing viewpoint, and to try to make it balanced, et cetera. But I think in light of what's in front of us during the summer, I don't want to add this more workload to the commission staff, and I think they're right about that part of it, and I think you're right on some of the indemnity issues and the issues that you are at, and I'd be open as one commissioner to we can put it on the August ballot. Would that be set on the August agenda?
Okay. Director Douglas, is that okay with you? Put it on the August agenda.
Sure.
Not on the last day, not at the last item.
That's fine.
Great. Thank
okay.
you.
We'll do that.
Is that okay?
It's
Is that
fine
okay
with me.
You? Okay. And we'll see everybody in Acadian land, where there's, I understand, free gas and cars and for everybody.
Oh, we have a public comment, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, yeah, we have one public comment. Julie Varon?
Yes.
Yeah. Three minutes, ma'am.
Thank you very much for giving me another bite. I'm speaking as an individual this time, as an individual owner of Blufftop Coastal Property in Wallala, and seven of us spoke to you on Wednesday opposing a fireworks proposal that in Wallala, and the main proponent also spoke yesterday at a meeting held by the Bureau of Land Management in Point Arena. The proponent, Marshall Saya, announced that they are going to proceed with the fireworks anyway, in spite of Mr. Merrill's letter to them asking, saying that they must have a coastal permit. Therefore, As a taxpayer in this state, I'm asking you to issue a cease and desist order. You saw the level of public concern among the people who objected on Wednesday. They could not convey, because it wouldn't even have been polite, the level of fear and intimidation that the fireworks supporters are working with. And it's really important not to have that go forward. And at the meeting yesterday, I said, well, you know, there's still plenty for the tourists to do because you're also having a shooting gallery in a building that's slated for demolition, and you're having a anyway, you need a federal consistency determination also, because they're going to, the BLM is still negotiating in private with these folks, and they are coming up with protocols for allowing fireworks in the coastal monument, which they said would be ready today, and I fully expected them to be here if they were going to show you any degree of courtesy, because I did give them Mr. Merrill's letter. So anyway, that's the site of the fireworks. The building that's going to be demolished is there, and the Sonoma County line is that dashed line at the very bottom. And the trail easement is right there in the middle. So I've got to go.
Mr. Chairman, I am aware of the situation. I did ask our staff member, Tiffany Tauber, to contact BLM, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Fish and Game, and indicate to them that there is no coastal permit for this, as well as the production company of the fireworks, that there is no coastal permit here, and that there needs to be a federal consistency review if, in fact, there is a formal federal action taken, permit or some sort of sanctioning of this by the federal agencies. The sponsors of the fireworks have indicated that they're going to proceed anyway, so I've asked staff to look at the potential of issuing a cease and desist order if, in fact, we have reason to believe that they are going to go ahead anyway, notwithstanding our letter. I hope they don't do that, because my feeling is that we can look at it and see if we can work out something so it can be done in a way to avoid adverse impacts to birds. I'm not sure whether that's possible, but that's the way it should proceed. And because they're doing this in an easement area, public easement area, I think it probably warrants a cease and desist order if, in fact, they're going to go ahead. So that's what I intend to do, and we're doing the best we can on it.
It's all we can do. Thank you, Director Douglas, and thank the staff and everyone. And we'll see everybody next month in San Luis Obispo, Commissioner Akajian territory.